Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. For the past 3 weeks, there have been ongoing protests in Egypt. It all began after President Mohamed Morsi granted himself near absolute power. The move was seen as tactics pulled straight out of former President Hosni Mubarak's playbook. According to Al Jazeera English's Listening Post, his media strategy echoes Mubarak's as well. State TV has been forced to broadcast Morsi's message nonstop. State media in Egypt is a colossal institution, and the Muslim Brotherhood has its own newspaper and TV network. But some journalists are fighting back. Joining us to talk about this is Shireen Tadros, Al Jazeera English's Middle East and North Africa correspondent, and she's joining us from London. Hi, Shireen. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks.
Nice to have you. We are also joined by Kevin Gostola. He is a writer and curator of Fire Dog Lake's blog, The Dissenter, which focuses on civil liberties. Kevin has been covering U.S. Army Private Bradley Manning's trial. He's the alleged source of some of the most important WikiLeaks reports over the past several years. Bradley Manning spoke about his treatment for the very first time. And Jessalyn Raddick of the Government Accountability Project writes that typically the only reporters consistently attending and covering the dramatic pretrial proceedings have been far outside the mainstream media, including Kevin Gostola. She says that major national newspapers have afforded the hearings limited summary attention at best. Now that Bradley Manning has been testifying about his abhorrent pre-trial confinement conditions, some in the mainstream media have woken up, but only to do brief stories that usually rely heavily on the Associated Press rather than doing their own independent investigation. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. And a little later in the show, we'll be joined by Marissa Taylor, investigative reporter with McClatchy. She just completed an in-depth investigation into federal government polygraph screenings. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Kevin, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, this week I'd like to give kudos to Jeffrey Kay and Jason Leopold because they shared the byline on this story. It's over at truthout.org. It's titled Latif Letter About Guantanamo Speaks from the Grave. Quote, I am being pushed toward death every moment. This is the prisoner whose death has been, as you could say, shrouded in controversy because it's unclear whether it was a suicide or if there was something more going on in the prison. And this letter that went to his lawyers in 2010 is detailed here, and it just basically suggests that Latif believed that he was being set up, that, quote, the way they deal with me proves to me that they want to get rid of me, but in a way that they cannot be accused of causing it. So I encourage people to read this.
And how long was he in Guantanamo? Where is he from?
Well, he's from Yemen, and he was there for... since early 2000, and he was being held indefinitely, and he had become pretty hopeless. But he was given a ray of hope when Amnesty International was about to take up his cause, and people were going to start writing letters to him to help in freeing him from the prison. He was never put on trial for anything, never charged. But he ended up dying in the prison. Mm.
Yeah, you know, you just reminded me, I have not read much about Guantanamo. We haven't done a show about that in a long time. We'll have to put that on our list for January. So thank you for that. And we will put that Truth Out piece on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Shireen, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I was really pleased this week to see on the BBC's 10 o'clock news a report by the Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen, from Bahrain. And I think that Bahrain's one of those Arab uprisings which unfortunately hasn't got a lot of attention compared to the others. And yet the battle in that country is raging. And he really humanized it and brought to light the complexity of what's going on there. And it's probably because it is so complex. And it's not just, you know, the sort of the simple pro-democracy protests. There's a sectarian issue. There's issues with Saudi Arabia and so on. And he sort of brought that to the fold, but also managed to show you that these are people who are struggling against a system that they feel is autocratic and not representative. So, I mean, I'm just pleased to see it on our screens.
What about Al Jazeera's coverage in Bahrain? Are there the reporters there? And I mean, the situation for journalists is horrific in Bahrain right now.
It is, and, you know, it's sort of on and off. Sometimes it's easier to get in than other times, but Al Jazeera always suffers from this problem of how dangerous it is for us to be inside compared to other reporters. You know, not that Syria is a safe place for any reporters. It's probably the most dangerous place in the world for a journalist right now, but Al Jazeera suffers that sort of extra stigma, you know, caught by either side. The rebels hate us, and the government hate us. So it's always hard. But yeah, Bahrain, I think for Al Jazeera English, we go in and out probably once a month. Someone will be in, but you always have to go in undercover. You come out and then you file. It's very difficult to file once you're there. And Al Jazeera Arabic has come under a lot of criticism for the lack of coverage of Bahrain. It's politically sensitive. Some of it's been unfair. I think it has, the channel covered Bahrain, but I certainly think that the English channel has gone above and beyond to cover Bahrain a lot more. I mean, there's a documentary that's won several awards done by a colleague of mine, May Ying Welsh, which was just, it's called Shooting in the Dark, and I really want to say that anyone who's interested in Bahrain should certainly take a look at that doc.
And a lot of that criticism is because of funding from the Qatari government, right?
And that's right. I mean, there's this idea that at the end of the day, this is a channel that is run by the Qataris, and it's sensitive that, you know, a kingdom like Bahrain, which is so close to Qatar, is under this sort of pressure. You know, it's almost the idea being, I suppose, you don't want to cover it too much to say that you don't give people at home the same idea, you know, any sort of ideas, a similar uprising. But I'm not sure it really carries a lot of weight as an argument. I think at the end of the day, it's just not a sexier story as Syria, Egypt. It doesn't have the same regional repercussions, and that's why it suffered from a lack of attention from all sorts of different media.
And that is Shireen Tadros, Al Jazeera English's Middle East and North Africa correspondent. And if you've been following these issues and have any questions about this, we'd love to hear from you. Shireen will be with us for about another 15 minutes. So now would be a good time to call. We're going to be talking about media coverage of the ongoing protests in Egypt and what is happening on the ground there, and also what is happening with a lot of journalists who are standing up to the state media. In fact, some state media reporters are stepping down because of demands from the new president, Mohamed Morsi, who just took power 5 months ago. The toll-free number, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment, yourcallradio.org. So before we get into the media coverage specifically and what's happening with state media and journalists who are fighting back, can you just give us a brief overview of what's been happening? Massive protests over the last 3 months after President Mohamed Morsi granted himself near absolute power. He's also planning to push through a draft constitution. And I understand that there are major anti-union measures in this constitution. First, talk about the power that he granted himself.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like 3 months, but it's more like 3 weeks ago that he granted himself these powers in this constitutional decree, as he called it. There were various articles, and actually some articles were very well received. There were articles that essentially put back on trial Hosni Mubarak, the former president, the former interior minister, because there was uproar in the country about the way in which these trials proceeded. So he, you know, within this decree gave the power to the court to put these men back on trial. He also gave powers to sack the prosecutor general, who was a Mubarak appointee, and stopping a lot of these trials going forward. So those were sort of good measures, if you like, went down well in the country. But, you know, in and amongst those, you saw these articles that said things like the president can take any measure in order to, quote, safeguard the revolution. I mean, that could mean anything. And then he took himself away from judicial oversight. So essentially, he could legislate without the judiciary having any sort of oversight over these laws. So he took the judiciary out of the system. And don't forget, this was a president that already had not just executive power, but also legislative power, because there's no parliament in Egypt. So this was unprecedented amount of power. I mean, Hosni Mubarak never had this sort of authority in the country. And given the fact that this is a country living in trauma of dictatorship and, you know, this sort of unaccountability, it really, you know, sent warning signs throughout the country, and people were just, you know, very, very worried. As it transpired, what happened was that, you know, he pushed through this draft constitution. And it's very unpopular for two reasons, the constitution, which where there's a referendum for it on Saturday. There's because of the process, because the assembly that wrote it was very unrepresentative. There were four women in this 100-member body. And, you know, writing this constitution. And the four women all belong to Islamist parties, either the Salafi parties, as in sort of ultra-conservative Islamic parties, or the Muslim Brotherhood's own party. There were no Christians. Not a single Christian representative of any kind of Christian church was there present writing this constitution or passed the laws. They basically, all the liberal, secular, religious representatives left the body because they said that the Brotherhood were completely dominating the system. So the end result, the document, is reflective of that. And people felt, oh, they actually call it in Egypt the Brotherhood's constitution. They don't call it Egypt's constitution. And that's obviously a huge problem. And you know, that's essentially what led to the weeks of protest. And it really polarized the country, because now it's really as if in Egypt you're either with the Brotherhood or you're against them. There's no middle way anymore.
And talk about how they are responding, because there have been testimonies from protesters. We've seen video clips and images of how the Muslim Brotherhood militias are beating and shooting protesters. There was a piece in the Egypt Independent in which a former diplomat who resigned in 2005 said, "They stood on my face and bounced on my chest." He said the Muslim Brotherhood doctors are refusing to give him medical care and told him they were prohibited by the Supreme Guide from attending to him. So can you talk a little bit about just the reaction to the protests?
Yeah, I mean, that was very interesting what happened. Essentially, what this whole thing has shown very clearly, and the fact that the military are the ones that are securing the country and the referendum right now, not the police, is that there's a serious breakdown in trust between the presidency and the police. I mean, there's this idea that the whole interior ministry is overrun by former regime remnants and supporters, and that they aren't actually willing to protect the president or public institutions and so on. So what ended up happening when these protests took place and they started taking place outside the presidential palace is that the Muslim Brotherhood felt the need to then go and send out their own people, if you like, to police crowd control and so on. And, you know, these terrible videos and images that we saw in the aftermath of these clashes where, you know, people were tortured, people were beaten up, all in sort of this extrajudicial way. And that's really just that's something that's continuing and something that really has to be addressed, because we haven't seen this happen before. You know, the ironic thing is that this is exactly what Hosni Mubarak used to do. I mean, he used to use his police, but far and beyond his police, there were these people where we commonly refer to them as thugs, or in Arabic, baltageya. And these were the people who would go around and actually round people up, torture them, basically teach them a lesson. If you know, you don't want to go out to these protests again, because this is what's going to happen to you. So, you know, very sad to see the same old tactics being used again.
And that is Shireen Tadros, Al Jazeera English's Middle East and North Africa correspondent. She'll be with us for a few more minutes. So if you have any questions or comments about what's happening on the ground in Egypt and media coverage, what are you seeing specifically from Western media outlets? 866-798-8255. It's our media roundtable today. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Yourcallradio.org. And Kevin, we're also joined by Kevin Gostola. He's a writer with Fire Dog Lake. There was a piece in the Epic Times that says Egypt's Arab Spring veterans are disappointed at what they are calling American media's unaggressive coverage of the protests that turned violent and deadly, as Facebook news feeds and YouTube channels are filled with images of anti-government protesters covered in blood. Activists complain that the U.S. media and government seem largely unmoved by their plight. The activists say American media and officials barely acknowledge the beating, abduction, and killing of liberal Egyptians in a return of Mubarak-style violent politics. What's your read on this? Have you been following coverage of the latest round of protests and the violence? Kevin?
I have. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I have, but I mean, I'm more interested in Shireen's take. In fact, I'd rather put it back to her, since she's going to be here for a limited amount of time, and maybe just ask because I've been following this as just somebody who observes. I haven't been writing about it specifically, but I do have an interest since the United States likes to use a lot of rhetoric about supporting the protesters and something that Obama adopted last year with the so-called Arab Spring. And so I'm just interested in, you know, if she's seeing any U.S. fingerprints on what the Brotherhood is doing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's pretty interesting. I'm just going to throw this theory out at you, because bear in mind that this decree that led to this round of violence and this crisis in the country came barely 24 hours after Mohamed Morsi, the president, negotiated the ceasefire in Gaza. So a lot of people at that time in the country started to say that the reason for the U.S. silence, and then finally I think they came out with a statement 2 days later saying that they were concerned about what was going on. So the reason for this sort of muted response by the U.S. was because there was some sort of agreement, or you know, whether written or more informal than that, between the U.S. and the Egyptian president, that he could do this sort of domestic controversial moves and the U.S. wouldn't say anything, as long as he played the regional role. I mean, don't forget, the Americans have to rely on Egypt to play this sort of mediating role with Hamas in Gaza. They rely on them for their relationship, you know, with Israel. They need to make sure that Egypt doesn't break that very important peace treaty with Israel. So Egypt is an important strategic player. The Muslim Brotherhood was an unknown before to them. So did they trade the sort of pro-democracy, you know, domestic politics for a larger guarantee of what Egypt would do in terms of foreign policy? I mean, I don't want to, you know, say my own opinion on it, but I'm just telling you what was certainly said in the country to explain why the timing of this decree and why the U.S. didn't say, you know, didn't react very much.
And quickly, before we get to calls, Shireen, what are your thoughts about activists saying that the Western media is ignoring the violence?
I think that it's not necessarily ignoring as much as misunderstanding. There's this thing in the media, the Western media, where everything is being played as sort of Islamist versus secular. Mm. You know, and I don't think it's that simple, actually. What's happening in Egypt is so much more complex than that. It's not just the seculars who are out on the streets protesting. It's actually everyone who doesn't necessarily want to see that kind of role for the state. So in the Constitution, for example, very quick example, there's one article that talks about the state's role being to guarantee high moral and religious values in the country. You don't have to be religious or not religious not to agree with that, to think, no, the state's role, theoretically even, is not to guarantee those things. That's a personal right. So, and there are people at these protests, and I was just at one a few days ago outside the presidential palace, a mass protest, and I would say maybe 50% of the females were veiled. You know, they're religious. They still oppose this constitution, and they still oppose Mohamed Morsi. So it's not a sort of clear Islamist-secular split, which I think is sometimes what we get from the Western media.
That's Shireen Tadros, Al Jazeera English's Middle East and North Africa correspondent, joining today's media roundtable. We're also joined by Kevin Gostola, a writer with Fire Dog Lake. And let's go through a few calls, and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Eid in Berkeley. Hi, Eid.
Hi, good morning. There is no question, you know, the American media is not at all doing enough coverage. But also, that idiot Morsi, he has done unbelievable thing. I have to remind you, two things. Number one, the Muslim Brotherhood were banned for many years, and lots of time and beyond. So they don't really represent a very big section of the Egyptian population. In fact, they're very few. And as a child myself, the attitude of Egyptians towards the Muslim Brotherhood was terrible, including myself when I was 7, 8 years old, because you could see them talking about Islam. Meanwhile, they were eyeing your sister when she was walking, you know, down the street. Mm. The fact is, he have totally destroy trust in himself. And by the way, I get, you know, first-hand information from my niece. She have a Facebook page under Sasu So, S-A-S-O space So. And you can see, you can't understand Arabic, but she have an awful lot of images. And I tell you, the caricatures or the cartoons of Morsi right now are so disgusting. I mean, they have him every possible way. As a baby in diapers, you know, going in the bathroom, as a donkey, as an animal, as everything. Most Egyptians hate him, and he has to go. The last thing I'd like to say, Egypt always, through the history, have been a secular country. Women in Egypt had freedom far long before American women had. 1919 revolution, for instance. So there is no way that idiot, ugly man will ever reverse the direction of the calendar as he is trying to do. Israeli, he has totally lost his credibility with the Egyptian people, and time for him to leave office.
All right. Well, thank you, Eid. We'll get a comment in just a minute. Let's hear first from Philip in Berkeley. Hi, Philip.
Hi. I'd like to know, your guest says that there's plenty of Mubarak people in holding high positions. Couldn't Morsi replace those people? And isn't it just an excuse for his, you know, usurpation of power to say that, oh, well, we're fighting all these Mubarak people? And also I want to know, how many seats does the Muslim Brotherhood have? Don't they have a lot of seats? And what's the vote count for Morsi? Did he win by a lot of votes? In other words, what kind of mandate does he have?
All right.
Thirdly, what is the military doing? Didn't Morsi make a deal with the military? Isn't that what this means, that he wouldn't have gone ahead if he didn't have the military behind him? So didn't he make a deal so to preserve their privileges and their business dealings and everything?
Okay, we'll get to that in just a minute. Thank you for the call, Philip. Let's go next to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to know, what is the relationship between the Salafi and the Muslim Brotherhood, and what are the Salafi saying about this crisis, and how are they interacting in it?
All right, thank you. These are pretty big questions. Sounds like we might have to do a show about Egypt. Do you want to take the one about the Salafis and the Muslim Brotherhood first, Shireen?
That's actually the one that I heard the best. So the Salafis have played an interesting political game in Egypt since they did so well in the elections.
And for people who aren't familiar with Salafis, just briefly.
Sure. I mean, these are an ultra-conservative Islamic group. They some people have compared them to a cult, but I think that that's not quite accurate. They're more conservative, certainly, than the Muslim Brotherhood. So they did very well in the last elections. They won about 20% of the parliament. And the party, which is the main party, is called the Noor Party. It was only just formed recently, in fact, after the uprising. And you didn't really hear very much about Salafis in Egypt until after the uprising, after the ousting of Hosni Mubarak. So there's always this question of how close are they to the Muslim Brotherhood? They weren't very much at the beginning. They were, in fact, arguing all the time in the parliament, the representatives. But what we've seen them completely ally with them in recent weeks over this constitution. I think the Muslim Brotherhood are very pragmatic, and they realize that they won. Well, Mohamed Morsi won with a very slim majority in the elections, the presidential elections, and they need that slice of Salafi representation if they're going to do well in the next parliamentary elections. So the Salafis have been quite split recently. Even the Noor Party at one point was going to have to split from internally because of disagreements, but right now I would say they are very closely aligned to the Muslim Brotherhood, especially over the constitution. They feel like they did very well out of that document.
All right, well, thank you for that. We're going to take a quick break. And Shireen, if you can stick around for just a few more minutes, we'll answer the other questions and then we'll let you go. And we'll switch gears also and talk about media coverage of Bradley Manning's trial. He spoke about his treatment for the very first time. We will also be joined by McClatchy's Marissa Taylor to talk about an investigative piece into polygraph screenings. And if you saw a piece out there that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear from you. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
All of the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. They're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to get. You can sign up for it. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. And you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling and joining today's conversation. 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Or send an email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Hi,
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea for us, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. On Monday, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about books. What was your favorite book of the year, either new or a classic? We'll get recommendations from you and independent bookstore owners. Today, it is our weekly media roundtable, and we are joined by Shireen Tadros, Al Jazeera English's Middle East and North Africa correspondent, and Kevin Gastola. He writes for Fire Dog Lake's blog, The Dissenter, which focuses on civil liberties. And Shireen, we had a couple more questions from you. You already talked about Morsi getting a slim majority of the vote. And what about the Muslim Brotherhood? How much power do they have? How many seats do they have?
Well, there's no parliament anymore. It was dissolved a few months ago by the Supreme Court. But they did have the largest slice in the parliament. I think that it's not necessarily accurate to interpret that as they are the most popular group in the country, simply because there was no other alternative at the time of the elections. The liberal parties were so new, and they didn't really know, in terms of mobilization of the masses, what they were doing. And that's unfortunately probably still the case. So they are the most powerful force in the country. They're the ones that are able to mobilize a network of voters and supporters very quickly. So that is for sure. And, you know, in this latest crisis, we've been able to see, you know, in numbers a little bit more, you know, probably 100,000 people or so across the country, when they want to mobilize them, they're able to do that, the Muslim Brotherhood, pretty easily. And these are supporters that they can really count on whatever Mohamed Morsi comes out to say. So, I mean, they're not to be underestimated, but I certainly think that they are being taken to task right now, because they were always in opposition, banned. They were the only really alternative to Hosni Mubarak. Now they're out there, you know, they're in power, they're in the presidency, and we're going to have to see in the next sort of year or so how they do, and whether or not Egyptians continue to support them, or whether their support was basically down to the fact that they were the only alternative.
Well, there's clearly a lot of interest in this, so we're going to have to do a show in the near future, and we'd love to have you back. Thank you so much for joining us, Shireen.
Sure, the pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you. Shireen Tadros is Al Jazeera English's Middle East and North Africa correspondent, and you can find more information about what's happening on the ground in Egypt. And also, a number of state television journalists are stepping down because they are basically being told to repeat Mohamed Morsi's line. A lot of journalists are fighting back. We'll continue covering this. We're going to switch gears now and speak with Kevin Gastola, Fire Dog Lake writer, about the Bradley Manning case. This is the U.S. Army private. He is the alleged source of some of the most important WikiLeaks reports over the past several years. The case just ended. For the very first time, he spoke out about his treatment. And Kevin, there's been so much, well, a little bit, I should say, written about the lack of media coverage of Bradley Manning's trial. Before we do this, because Bradley Manning doesn't really get much attention, let's just go back and talk about who he is and what he allegedly leaked to WikiLeaks. Can you give us a little bit of context here?
Yes. So, you know, Bradley Manning's this soldier who was an Army, I'll call him an analyst. He was working at Forward Operating Base Hammer in Iraq. One of the jobs that he had, which has been detailed in these proceedings over the past year, is that he would look at the information, and this is how he came to allegedly release these sets of documents to WikiLeaks. One of the jobs he had granted him access to something called CIPRNet, which is a secret information network that all agencies in the United States use for their operations. And, you know, he was working on the Iraqi elections and was tasked with putting together some products that could be used for that by U.S. forces. And so Bradley Manning is alleged to have released the collateral murder video showing a 2007 Apache helicopter attack. Two Reuters journalists are gunned down. There's a van that pulls up trying to rescue them and then is shelled. There's the Iraq war logs, the Afghan war logs. These are sets of military incident reports. Some of these reports showing instances of torture. In fact, in Iraq, a policy, Brago 242, that Petraeus would have been involved in, which was looking the other way and just letting detainees go into the hands of Iraqi death squads and not really doing anything about it. And then the biggest thing, I think, that really had the United States government on edge, particularly the State Department, in December 2010, the release of the U.S. State Embassy cable diplomatic communications among high-level diplomats and also foreign leaders around the world, revealing, you could run down a list of different examples of corruption, deceit, bribery, fraud, torture in some cases, war crimes in some cases, human rights abuses, working on behalf of corporations to sell their software or hardware or equipment as part of a foreign policy agenda. This is just, this is the whole range of diplomacy from the past decade really was unveiled to the world over the past year from, if you go from December 2010 to August 2011.
He was arrested, Bradley Manning, in May 2010. He faces 22 counts associated with these leaks. And the government is arguing that the leaks constitute aiding the enemy, apparently because the material he leaked made their way onto the computers of some Al-Qaeda figures. This is what government officials are saying. The few reports about his trial fail to include much context. In fact, very few of them talk about the documents he allegedly leaks to WikiLeaks. Why do you think that is?
Well, I guess I'll sort of excuse it because I have to take responsibility and say that in my coverage of this recent hearing, I didn't put too much about the materials that were leaked this round. But that's simply because what was remarkable about this hearing is that witnesses were taking a stand describing the nature of his confinement at Quantico, and that's really a key element of understanding the way that the United States government responded to these alleged leaks, because Bradley Manning was held for 9 months at Quantico Marine Brig from July 29, 2010, all the way through April 20, 2011, until being transferred to Fort Leavenworth in Kansas and being put in much better conditions. But for the period of time he was held there, he was put on prevention of injury watch and held as a maximum custody detainee. And from a lot of the evidence that I saw presented in court, there wasn't really much of a basis. This was all arbitrary on the part of brig officers to place them under these strict conditions and simply done on the fact that they either viewed him to be a national security risk, maybe they didn't want him talking to other detainees about what he allegedly did, or they found Bradley Manning to be this oddball sort of soldier who didn't behave like your typical soldier. He is intelligent. He is smart. He likes to engage in political discussion. He read science magazines. He's a bit more intellectual, I think, than the average soldier. He would dance in his cell. He had an imagination. He wasn't your typical cookie-cutter person that you see in the military.
Well, and also, just to be specific, he was in a cage or a small windowless cell for 23 hours a day. He was given 20 minutes of what they call, quote, sunshine call, during which he could walk figure eights in restraints with guards holding him up. And then also at one point, this did get a lot of attention when this happened, but he was forced to be nude, right? I mean, he even had to hand over his underwear.
Yeah, that is correct. The commander, she took the stand. Her name is Denise Barnes, and she was in charge of this brig. And she made a decision, in fact, improperly. Not to get too weedy, but you have to put a soldier on suicide risk if you're going to take their clothing. That came out in the proceedings. And she violated her authority by carving out this own, handling instruction for Bradley Manning and just deciding, oh, well, I don't want to put him on suicide risk because that might invite too much attention. And then the medical officer, the psychiatrist, would have the power to tell me to give him back his underwear. So since I want to take it away from him, I'm going to do it in my own special way. And in fact, a person in the higher rankings of the Marine Corps sent her an email and said, this is not how we're supposed to do business.
That is Kevin Gustola. He writes for Fire Dog Lake's blog, The Dissenter, which focuses on civil liberties. He's been extensively covering the Bradley Manning case. The New York Times was criticized because they did not send a reporter. They finally did on the last day of the trial, and we'll talk with Kevin about that. He wrote about it. And now I would like to welcome Marissa Taylor to the show. Marissa is an investigative reporter for McClatchy, which operates 30 newspapers, including the Sacramento Bee and the Fresno Bee. Marissa's not feeling so well today, so she's joining joining us a little late, but thank you so much for still agreeing to be on the show, even though you're sick, Marissa.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And you did a great investigation into polygraph screenings, which we'll talk about after we discuss Bradley Manning. But I wanted to ask you, Marissa, since you do cover cases involving the federal government and whistleblowers, why do you think this case did not get much attention? I mean, in fact, most major newspapers relied on Associated Press reports.
I'm at this point more familiar with security procedures that are put in place that are being debated that about how the government keeps its secrets, and that is more relevant to the Bradley Manning case in the sense that at this point the reason the government is arguing that it has to prosecute Manning is because if they don't prosecute him, then he is an example of someone who has gotten away with leaking important government secrets. And my understanding is that he was actually polygraphed and went through screening and polygraph screening. And as part of his screening for his current job, his intelligence job that he had at the time of his arrest. And there is a huge bureaucracy that has been set up by the government to guard what it says are important secrets when there's a debate over whether the government is properly deeming these to the actual documents and information to be classified when maybe it shouldn't be. And in the case of Bradley Manning, I think that is a very important debate over whether what is being classified at this point by the government and whether too much is being classified.
Well, and can you talk a little bit about that, Kevin, about what is being classified and, whether too much is being classified and what do we know about what was leaked?
Right. I think that's going to be critical in this case. I guess I would just say to preview what would be upcoming when we get to the main trial in March. Part of the defense is going to be looking at these sets of documents that were released and suggesting that they were not properly classified. One really critical video, the collateral murder video, has already, in the course of these proceedings, gone from being something that was sensitive and classified to being quite clearly unclassified. And, it's hard to say what would be the purpose of going after Manning for releasing an unclassified video. So this is one charge that David Coombs's lawyer has pushed to not plead guilty to not go along with the other 22 charges.
That is Kevin Gostola, a writer with Firedog Lake blog, The Dissenter. We're also joined by Marissa Taylor, investigative reporter with McClatchy, who recently completed an in-depth investigation into polygraph screenings. More than 73,000 Americans across the country submitted to polygraph tests to keep jobs with the federal government, although the screening is mostly banned in the private sector and widely denounced by scientists. And if you have any questions about media coverage of Bradley Manning, he doesn't really get that much coverage. This trial didn't get much coverage. Most major newspapers relied on the AP. The New York Times finally sent a reporter on the last day of the trial because of pressure. So if you have any questions or comments on this, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And if there was another story you saw this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd love to hear about it. And so, Kevin, can you just give us a little an overview of the New York Times? They were criticized by their own blog for not sending a reporter, and then they finally did on the last day. And you said that the major problem with it is that it lacked any context, and the reporter wasn't there for most of the trial, so really didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, well, what's key is that this was more than just Bradley Manning testifying. I think that's important to let listeners understand, because this wasn't just about Manning getting up on the stand and getting a first time to speak, as a lot of the media presented it. It was much more than that. This was a critical pretrial hearing about Manning's rights being allegedly violated while he was held at the Quantico Brig. And all of these commanding officers, these guards, people who were involved in Manning's confinement, psychiatrists, took the stand and were giving very incredible testimony, I think, that gave us a complete picture of what it was like through those 9 months. And so with the case of the New York Times, they sent Scott Shane on Friday, I think about a week ago. They had Charlie Savage go on Tuesday when they gave closing arguments. But they were doing these reports without having a complete understanding of what had actually been going on in these proceedings. So, for example, they would say in one of their reports that his confinement in Kuwait was very traumatic for Bradley Manning, and there were a lot of harsh conditions that Manning detailed in his testimony. But this part about Manning being held in an animal cage, which is how Manning described it, is not actually part of what the defense was trying to get some relief for. They were just focused on his Quantico confinement. So that was one of the things that I believe they got wrong. But also, what they were doing was confusing the nature of this conditional plea, which people have heard a little bit about. I guess I would just like to say briefly, because people believe that Manning now, because of sloppy reporting, has made a deal with the government, and he's pleading to some lesser charges. It's a lot more complex than that. I don't think we have a lot of time to go into it on this show, but just to say that he's put forward a plea to the judge, and if she accepts it, then there's a possibility that she changed the way things are going to move forward, and maybe some of the more severe charges, like the charge of aiding the enemy, could potentially be thrown out, or else it would be handled individually. But he hasn't cut a deal with the government. It's just what's really critical here, and it's something that was misreported by the New York Times. Mm.
Well, and so the trial, there's going to be, the trial resumes in March? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, there's pretrial hearings all along the way, but the main trial, the one that I hope more media will tune into, will be in March.
All right, and we'll definitely do a show. And I should also say that since we are joined by McClatchy's Marissa Tyler, Nancy Youssef, Marissa's colleague at McClatchy, did cover the Bradley Manning trial. And you can find more information about this at yourcallradio.org. And Marissa, you mentioned a polygraph screening, and you just completed an in-depth investigation into these screenings. And it's fascinating information. Polygraphers at a number of U.S. agencies are asking applicants very personal questions about their personal lives. You report that more than 73,000 Americans across the country submitted to polygraph tests to keep their jobs or get a job with the federal government. And this was an in-depth investigation. First of all, what prompted this investigation?
I actually did a series of stories on the spy satellite agency for the United States. It has a program that screens applicants, and they're mostly contractors, private contractors across the country, and they have to undergo polygraph screening, polygraph tests to get a job. And I had polygraphers who came to me and alleged that they were being pressured to collect information that was much more personal than they were allowed to collect. They were supposed to be sticking to counterintelligence issues, like whether someone's a spy, what kind of foreign contacts they have. And instead, they said they were being pressured to get information about people's personal lives, their marriages, adultery, whether they did drugs. And this, they argued, was outside of their legal limits. And after we did those stories, I became interested in what the entire federal government was doing and tried to document how many people were actually being polygraphed by the federal government, since it is banned among private employers by Congress in 1988. The Congress chose to ban it for private employers, but allowed the federal government in many circumstances to continue the use of polygraph screening. And I found that even though the National Academies, which was formed by President Lincoln to advise the United States on scientific matters, even though they had gone through polygraph studies and determined that the federal government should not be currently using polygraph to screen people for jobs, that the government had continued to not only do it, but had become, in some cases, much more personal in its inquiries of in terms of what polygraphers were asking, what areas they were exploring of people's lives during these tests, which can be often hours and over multiple sessions. So one applicant told me about being polygraphed by the CIA at 19 years old when she was recruited by the CIA, and she contended that they did not ask her about her ability to guard government secrets, but interrogated her about her reported rape and miscarriage. And she said that she felt like she was being told that in order to get through the polygraph test and pass it, she had to tell them everything she was thinking. And as a result, this can turn into, many people have described to me, it can turn into what is almost a classic police interrogation, where you delve into all sorts of issues when you are just applying for a job or a security clearance.
I'm glad you brought up that example, because that was a very clear-cut example of what's happening. But I was also kind of surprised to learn that a 19-year-old is being recruited to work for the CIA.
Yes, so there are many people who are still in university who are approached by intelligence agencies. And she was one of the brightest students at her university. We withheld her name because of the personal information.
Well, that would be, I think, a fascinating story, just the young people who are being recruited to work for the CIA and what they're doing. You interviewed dozens of polygraphers, national security experts, and people who've been screened and found vast differences in how the tests are conducted. Once these tests are conducted, and again, we're talking about, 73,000 every year, what is done with all of this information? Because this is, like you said, highly personal and intimate information.
It is often, it is either audio taped or videotaped, depending on the agency, it's videotaped. And then now it is often kept for a certain period of time. Depending on the agency, they will sometimes keep the actual reports for decades. And I spoke to someone who is a high-level former Republican advisor who... He himself had to contest his polygraph screening and the allegations that were leveled against him. And he actually ended up winning a case before administrative court. But it's very difficult for people to challenge what polygraphers say about them, because it's all secret. People aren't given the tapes, even though they're often taped interrogations or interviews, and as a result, they have very little ability to challenge what is being said about them or what is being said about what they themselves said. So the agency will say, I'm not going to give you the job, or I'm going to revoke your clearance because you said X during a polygraph session, and if the person believes that to be untrue, it is very difficult for them to get a transcript of what they supposedly said, and it is nearly impossible to get the taped session. And this is because it is all in the context of national security.
And you also report that, sorry to cut you off, we're just almost out of time, and I want to make sure we get this out, that the U.S. military conducted hundreds of polygraph tests on detainees in Iraq and Afghanistan, despite doubts about whether innocent civilians could be, quote, accurately separated from accused terrorists. And one of the polygraphers you spoke with worried that military personnel were falsely implicating people.
Actually, what was very interesting about this is that this is all documents. These were the primary documents that a researcher I talked to got under FOIA, under open records laws. And it's actually the written surveys of what their impressions were of what was going on, and including at Abu Ghraib, where a polygrapher described in documents how he felt that he had cleared somebody during a polygraph, and that his conclusions about that were ignored, and the person was still sent to Abu Ghraib prison, even though that person was innocent.
Have you had any response from government officials? Will there be any investigation into these polygraphs?
Well, there is currently one investigation of the spy satellite agency's program, but there is not, as far as I'm aware right now, a broader look at the use of polygraph screening. And at this point, Congress has been reticent to weigh in because it's in the national security context, that, and the federal government argues that it's necessary to protect the country from spies and terrorists.
And Kevin, we have about 30 seconds. Final thoughts from you on this, because you do cover these issues, especially whistleblowers. What are your thoughts on Marissa's in-depth investigative piece and what she found on polygraphs?
I mean, it's profound. I mean, it's incredible reporting. And I would just briefly state that a lot of the response, I think, in secrecy and protecting and going over these officials and subjecting them to polygraphs, it's my sense that this has only been amplified, and they've only ramped up this activity just because of the WikiLeaks, just because of these releases. It's been part of the response of government to respond so sharply.
Well, we're out of time, unfortunately, but thank you both so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us. Kevin Gostola is a writer with Fire Dog Lake's blog, The Dissenter. Marissa Taylor, investigative reporter from McClatchy. And you can find their pieces on Bradley Manning and the polygraph tests at yourcallradio.org. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What were your favorite books of the year? As 2012 comes to a close, we'll make a list of the best books of the year, both new and classic. Do you have friends or family you'd love to give a book to if only you had a recommendation? We'll get a few from independent bookstore owners and you. Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What's your book gift idea and what are you reading? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Next time on Smiley and West from PRI.
Oh, dear brother, what a genius he is, Wynton Marsalis.
So much to talk about with the composer, trumpet master, and educator, including the 25th anniversary of jazz at Lincoln Center.
Can't wait to talk with that brother, Wynton Marsalis.
Next time on Smiley and West
from PRI.
Smiley and West, this afternoon at 1 o'clock, following the Tavis Smiley Show at noon. That's just an hour away here on Local Public Radio. Next, of course, from the World Service of the BBC, World Have Your Say. This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco. Online, kalw.org, Local Public Radio. Please feel free on our website to join us, become a member of Local Public Radio. Just click on the link that says Donate Now. It's 11 o'clock, KALW San Francisco.
Hello, this is World Have Your Say. I'm Ben James. An hour of live discussion on the BBC that you can take part in via Facebook, Twitter and Google+.
I think it's important on a day like today to view this as, I know, the president as a father does, and I as a father, and others who are parents certainly do.
That's White House spokesman Jay Carney. Details have been emerging over the last hour about a shooting at an elementary school called Sandy Hook in Newtown, Connecticut. We're going to bring you the latest information and reaction over the next hour on the programme. Footage posted online shows adults helping young children to safety across a car park. We're expecting to hear from the local police in Connecticut shortly. As you listen to the programme, you can contribute with the hashtag WHYS. We're also on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay.